on some level, we've totally neglected primal communication because, like, you know, Cesar Millan can't communicate with a dog with words. We've neglected that there's an entire conversation happening between bodies that you cannot speak over. You can talk, say powerful things, say disempowering things, do whatever you want, but you can't neglect that level of communication.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Imagine if you could get some of the best insights from podcast guests on creativity, productivity, and what it takes to make your work unmistakable. Well, if you haven't picked it up yet, that's exactly what I did with my last book, Unmistakable: Why Only It Is Better Than Best. I put together all the best insights combined with some of my own thoughts on what it takes to create work that's unmistakable. It might make a perfect stocking stuffer, and it might just inspire you to start that creative project you've been thinking about. And as always, today's episode is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So if you've been thinking about this creative project, now is actually a really good time to start, since we're right around the corner from the end of the year. And if nothing else, just buy a domain name. The thing that I've found often is when you don't know what the next steps are, sometimes it's taking the first steps that reveals the rest. And our friends at HostGator are awesome for helping you get started, because they have 24/7 live support via phone chat and email, a super easy to use website builder if you're not tech savvy, and if you hate your current hosting provider and you want to switch, they make it easy and free. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Kasia, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Yeah. So I was introduced to you by way of Bob Gower, and when he told me a little bit about what you did, I was very, very intrigued. And I almost never start an interview with this question, but given what you do, I figure it would be an interesting way to start. So when people ask you the question, what do you do for work, what do you tell them? How do you explain what you do?
Well, if I'm speaking one-to-one, mm-hmm. I have a lot of freedom in how I approach that answer. But in this case, I best be broad. I teach power to women. Uh-huh. And I have a school where a lot of the focus is breaking apart or seeing through the patterns that are usually invisible, specifically around women's behavior, mm-hmm. and their approach to getting what they want.
Okay. So I guess the question is, what's the path to sort of ending up in that line of work? Like, I don't imagine that, you know, you open a career guide and say, you know what, this is exactly what I want to do.
Yeah, it was a total accident. I spent about 17 years being a professional dominatrix, a very successful one, in New York and other places in the world. And for the first years, the only reason I was doing that was because I knew how to make really good money, mm-hmm. and I was pursuing a path as a Taoist. So my dream was to be a Taoist nun. I got as close as 4 days away from ordination, but fate had other plans for me. What I noticed over the years was that what I was learning about Taoist martial arts, Taoist healing, energetic practices, how to read a body, how to see when somebody is collapsing in on themselves or ready to attack, or energetically, behaviorally doing something that reflects what they're at, and how the human body communicates with other human bodies in that sphere. And as I was studying, I started realizing that in the dungeon, where I'm paid to have power over a man, a lot of those same ways of being would show up. A lot of the same patterns that men have, that women have, would show up. And this only amplified when I started being hired to train other dominatrixes in dungeons. And we're talking about like 18, 19-year-old girls who don't quite know why they're there. Mm-hmm. And they're supposed to act like they have power over a man. And that getting them to a place where they're actually doing what it is that they're supposed to do versus looking like what they're supposed to do, was where all the stuff from my Taoist training started coming into play. And the number one thing was where they place their attention. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so that's how that started. I mean, over years. Yeah.
So two questions. One, what misperceptions do you think that people have about the types of people who do this work? And what misperceptions do you think that we have about the types of people who are clients of this kind of work?
You know, in a weird way, I am probably least able to speak about BDSM. Uh-huh. Because when I worked as a dominatrix, it became such a singular thing. Like, I ended up having so little contact with other people in the BDM scene. And what I ended up doing was so specific that I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. One thing that I know that happened for me is I stopped very quickly looking at doms and subs as separate from people who are not interested in anything kinky. So I'd see a power dynamic in the workplace or in a relationship, and I would see people trying to dom and sub to each other in exactly the same ways that I would have seen in a session.
Wow. So just out of curiosity, I mean, I don't know how much of this you can really, I mean, what are the types of people who come to this work, both men and women? I mean, from both perspectives, like, do they come from all walks of life? Are they people who, like, you know, in their normal, is this like an alternative personality for them? Or I'm just curious, like, are they people who we, you know, are interacting with on a daily basis and wouldn't even know it?
Yes, absolutely. It's people that we're interacting with on a daily basis and wouldn't even know it. But I think it also speaks to a larger thing that's happening in the world, because especially at the time where I was starting out, I feel like a lot of the men that came to me, of course, they were men that had money. Mm-hmm. And IT was growing fast. So it was like IT people, Wall Street people, contractors, a lot of Hasidic Jews. It was really... it really felt to me like it was about how, in order to become a man and be a man in the world, mm-hmm. even the term man up means to a certain extent disconnecting from your feeling sense. Like, not just your emotions, but the part of you that feels things out. And what I started noticing is that women tend to have such a intense connection with their feeling sense and the emotions that result, that it becomes really difficult for them to even know what to do with them, given that there isn't enough place for them to not just express them and have them, but to use them well. So one of the things that I started noticing is that the difference between being an agency in its relationship in a power dynamic. So like when you're raising kids, and you have a little girl and a little boy, the tendency has been that any praise towards the girl has to do with her beingness. Look how nice Mary's being. Look how pretty she looks. The attention is on Mary, where if it's a boy being raised, there's this tendency to approve of his agency over his being. So it's not like, look how well behaved and how nice Billy's being. It's like, look what Billy did. And that has... over time, I think an impact on how we identify ourselves in the world as whether we are how we seem and how we're being, or whether we are good or bad based on what we're able to accomplish.
Hmm. So what is it that brings people to, you know, this whole BDSM scene, like, the, you know, to go and to hire a dominatrix or even hire somebody like you? What kinds of things in their lives cause them to come to somebody like you that you've seen? Like, what is the sort of motivation behind it?
You know, the reasons are so varied that I don't think that there's a pattern to them. I mean, really, like, one of the reasons that I've transitioned away from being a dominatrix and into teaching about power and power dynamics is I think that there's this general overall situation where men want to know how to feel more and women want to know how to do more with what they feel. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty much a laboratory for me to discover that and then learn how to apply it to power dynamics and teaching it in various places, like whether it's in my school or whether it's at Yale or whether it's, you know, corporate environment or whether it's regarding an intimate relationship between a man and a woman who are stuck in a marriage they can't stand anymore and don't know why, mm-hmm. or people who are having the same familial vicious cycle argument over and over again and feel trapped and want to get out. And what they can't see is that they're totally in a collapsed power dynamic.
Okay, so I think that really sets up what I want to spend the rest of our time talking about, which is sort of this whole power dynamic and how it comes into play. I'd love for you to walk us through sort of the foundations of what, you know, actually being able to be powerful involves for somebody.
Okay, so I'm going to use a metaphor directly from the dungeon, right? Okay. I'm a dominatrix. Say, put me in that dungeon with a man who's naked on all fours. And say he wants a spanking. There's going to be the smack that's a little too light, and over time that's going to irritate him. There's going to be the smack that shuts his body down so he can't feel more. And then there's going to be the smack that's just right, that makes his body light up and makes him feel more. In any given power dynamic, the connection between the two people works best when you can find that right-sized smack. The place where I think people get really screwed in power in general is in how they deal with resistance. Say you want to influence somebody, you want to convince them of something. This happens very, very, very quickly in my classes when I ask the women in the class to ask somebody else for something. Women do not want to ask. They do not want to ask, especially if it's meaningful to them, especially if it's something really important. They do not want to ask for anything. And one of the main reasons for that is they're afraid of hearing no. The first sign of resistance equals total invalidation. And the thing is that in terms of resistance, there's generally two ways that people deal with it. They either try to crush it or they run away. And then there's this middle way of dealing with resistance where you get curious about what's going on. So somebody says no, and you get curious about what their no is about. And suddenly you end up in a situation where you have a person who can actually trust you enough to give you more of their world so that you understand what's behind the no, and you can find a way to get either a yes or you can get something else. And the thing about women in power dynamics in specific is that they're so used to putting attention on themselves that they don't even know that they're not doing this. Putting attention on the other person past the no, past the point of resistance, to get into their world and feel them out and see what's actually there, to find a place where they can meet, because the place where they meet is the equivalent of the right-sized slap.
What about men in power dynamics? Like, what are their tendencies that you've noticed?
Men have been told to man up so long, and for millennia have had to go to war and shut off their feelings in order to be men, that a lot of times men will tend to be in the power dynamic structure, DOMs, which means they put their attention out on what they want. They put their attention out. And if somebody's a DOM over a long period of time, they risk losing connection with their own feeling sense. So that means that they can do and do and do, influence, have power over, but not actually be present to the results that are getting created. And that looks like tyrannical force. I mean, the metaphor for that is any tyrannical government is a bad DOM. So men are encouraged into this position where they're the equivalent of dictators that will by force try to create the results that they want. And that's not a sustainable model of power. It doesn't work. There's so many reasons why it doesn't work. We've seen it through history that what results is a rebellion where the coup that replaces the dictator ends up being exactly the same as the dictator in the first place. It doesn't include influence. And to have influence, you need to have a feedback pattern. So when you put your attention out in order to achieve a particular result, especially in a dyad with two people, right? The dom puts attention on the sub, finds the point of resistance and gets curious about it, then you stand a chance at having actual influence. So where men will collapse a power dynamic is that they'll stop feeling the feedback, or they won't know that they're off the mark. And for women, they'll think that they are expressing themselves, exerting power, but what they're saying, what they're doing with their energy, with their body language, with their vocal projection doesn't actually reach the other person, doesn't land in the body of the other person, nor does it create a situation where the other person feels like they can trust with their whole body what's being said and follow. So self-consciousness is one way of calling what it looks like. But a lot of it for me is just the habit pattern of having intention in.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about this because, you know, when I've thought of influence and persuasion in the past, or, you know, the way it's presented in a lot of sort of social psychology and material, is that it ends up being sort of a zero-sum game where one person gets what they want and the other person doesn't. But, you know, what you're describing to me doesn't sound like a zero-sum game at all. It sounds like creating a power dynamic where everybody's actually better off.
Absolutely. And in the classes that I teach, one of the reasons I teach women to be able to be better subs and better doms is because when you're in a situation and power dynamic where somebody's doming you badly, right? They're like trying to exert control or force and it's not hitting the spot. It's not creating anything. There's nothing but resistance, right? Even if it's a boss that's barking orders and missing the true gifts of the employees, trying to force them into something that doesn't work, then it's the job of the sub to learn how to switch. And switching dynamics is crucial. And if you watch any casual conversation that feels good, what you'll notice is that dom and sub is totally switching fluidly all the time. You have somebody who is speaking and speaking into the listening of another person. Then you have a person who's listening and then can feel the moment where it's time to switch. And it's that level of subtlety that I think is really important in understanding power dynamics in general. Like when women really want to exert themselves as powerful and dominant, what they usually do is the equivalent of self-detonation. They have all their attention in, they start screaming, and their energy is still not reaching anybody. Everybody else around is just getting hit with shrapnel. She's not actually reaching, feeling, and moving things in the other person.
So we're right around the corner from the end of the year, and you've heard from a whole variety of different people about what the world is going to look like. You've heard David Berkus talk about the future of work. You've heard Chase Jarvis say that we're moving more and more towards a portfolio model of careers where we can actually showcase our work that we've done. And one of the easiest ways to do that, of course, is to build a website. In fact, it's something that I think everybody should learn how to do at some time or another. And since we're right around the corner from the end of the year, it's a perfect time to get started. And that's where our friends at HostGator come in, because they have 30% off all of their hosting packages for Unmistakable Creative listeners. If you're not tech savvy, a super easy to use website builder, and if you want to move hosts from the host that you're currently on, they make it super easy and it's completely free. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Okay, so you know, I think what I want to talk about now is you know, how do you create favorable power dynamics in different contexts? You know, we've really kind of looked at it from, you know, men and women. I'm curious, in the context of sort of mating relationships, even in the early phase of a relationship, I'm curious kind of, you know, how do you create a favorable power dynamic and also, you know, find this balance between not coming across needy but not being so aggressive that you scare somebody off because you seem crazy? And then I'd like to look at it also through the lens of leadership and business.
Okay. So this might sound a little bit weird, but one of the most important pieces I got was when I was working in a dungeon and I was reading Cesar Millan's book, The Dog Whisperer, dog training. And there's this whole section about how human beings forget that their dog is an animal. It's like primarily an animal and a dog, and then a breed, and then a name. Like they look at their dog and they're like, look, there's Tinkerbell, right? And they forget the absolutely primal animal realities of the dog. And I was reading this and I suddenly felt like that's exactly the same with humans. That on some level, we've totally neglected primal communication because, like, you know, Cesar Millan can't communicate with a dog with words. We've neglected that there's an entire conversation happening between bodies that you cannot speak over. You can talk, say powerful things, say disempowering things, do whatever you want, but you can't neglect that level of communication. And in terms of mating and relationships, it becomes really simple from the perspective of women and from the perspective of men in different ways. Women need to ask for what they feel, right? They're connected to their feeling sense, to the animal of the body, right? They feel when they're safe, they feel when they're in danger. and they feel when they long for something. And breaking the taboo over voicing those things and voicing those things well in such a way where the fear of no longer exists. I mean, how many, if not you personally, how many people do you know that have been in relationships where the guy's like, I would totally do anything to make this woman happy if I had a fucking clue as to what it was? Or how many times has a guy gone out of his way to meet a woman's request and did not exactly feel her light up when she got it?
Yeah.
Chances are it's because before that request came out of her mouth, it was already compromised. It wasn't the exact thing that she was feeling. She negotiated it through her system depending on what she thought she could get away with or what she thought she could get a yes to so she wouldn't get a no. Mm-hmm. And when that level of self-censorship in a male-female dating, mating, relationships dynamic eventually kills it or makes it suck, regardless. Like, that's a primary point. She can feel things. She wants things. And if she negotiates with herself before speaking, it's already dead. It's already screwed. Because there's already unfulfilled things that exist in her system that over time are going to become more irritable. She won't even know why she's unhappy, why she's being critical, why she's being passive aggressive. She won't know. Mm-hmm. And so that's like the first basic thing. And teaching a woman how to deal with the resistance that a man might present is super important so that she's not afraid to ask anymore. And for a guy, you know, I don't teach men, but if most men could understand what a woman goes through just to be okay with what she wants and what it takes for her to get it out of her system and to like speak it into space and then to have it heard, he would stand a chance at having the satisfaction of being the man who can totally light a woman up by honoring the simplest request and not standing for the first, most compromised, self-negotiated, spoken version of that ask.
Do you find that men have a similar challenge? Because I'm just thinking of this with the lens of some of my own experiences with this, where I feel like I've compromised on numerous things where I'm like, you know, I'm not good with this, but I'm willing to put up with it.
You mean compromise in asking for things or compromise in reacting to things?
Being passive aggressive. It's funny when you described all of that, I was like, I think I've done every one of those things in relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, also in a lot of ways to build a curriculum or to teach, I have to use a lot of stereotypes and broad strokes. But the truth is that like the same things that women are going through, men are going through in a different way. Mm-hmm. Because gender, what we understand gender to be is collapsing, but we still have very old school gender, like psychic education, if you know what I mean. You know, like now a guy has to worry about being like where a woman has to worry about sounding bossy or needy, mm-hmm. a guy has to start worrying about the same shit. He's like, I don't want to be one of those toxic masculine types, but I don't want to be a wuss either. Mm-hmm. And those are both fears of going dom and sub. It's the same thing. It's like, you don't want to put your attention out too aggressively and miss, especially these days. And especially as a man, because a woman probably won't tell you when you're getting it wrong. A woman won't even tell you if you're ever having sex with her and it hurts. Like, this is it's everywhere. It's all over the place. But then if you become too sensitive and too passive and you let things slide and you let things build, your own resentment grows and you feel pretty weak. So it totally applies to men. The only reason I don't speak so bravely about it is because I haven't had the experience yet of teaching men, aside from the men who come to volunteer for the school, who are a wonderful group of men who come in just so that we can practice an experiment on men.
I guess, you know, for me, I mean, I kind of have seen both tendencies in my own life to either pull away completely when I'm like, okay, I'm going to end up seeming too needy, or to be the complete opposite. I'm curious how you find the balance.
The balance between the two? I don't. I go for doing both extremes really well. Mm-hmm. So like needy would mean your energy, your being, your entirety is withdrawing. You're going inward. So I would say if you're feeling needy, go even further into the direction of that and feel exactly the totality of what it is that you want. Get to a place where you feel legitimate about wanting it, not necessarily having the other person provide it for you, but getting right with that you want it and allowing yourself to enjoy the hell out of how wonderful it would be to have that. And then, you know, in the presence of the person who you want provide it for you, be really transparent and describe what it's like, describe what the feeling is, describe how wonderful it would be. And that's a submissive request. That's a submissive ask. Or when you've just fucking had it and you want to lay down the law and you want to be bossy, then go all out and be like, look, and put the attention on the other person. Instead of going, I'm really hurt, go, you're doing this and it's causing this. And now I want you to do this. I want you to, you're going to do this other thing. You're going to try it this way and this way. And then you watch, see if resistance comes up and then get curious about it. Oh, this person said no, or they got scared. Did I scare you? Did that request make you feel uncomfortable? Why did it make you feel uncomfortable? Is there anything I can do to make you feel safe right now? So is there a way that, and you keep going. It's the place in the middle where you're squeezing your emotions into a tiny little place and you're pretending that your own personal desires don't matter, but wanting them anyway will make you needy. Or when you're squishing all of that shit in and what you really want to do is have influence over somebody and you try, it's not going to land. It's not going to. Not only is it not going to land, you're not going to be present enough to their experience to be able to take care of them and influence them there. So you make choices, right? And sometimes when you don't know which one to do because you have the feeling of both, miracles happen when in the span of a single conversation, you can try one, then try the other, then try the other again. And not in the same sentence. Giving each enough time just so you can watch the body of the other person, see how they respond, watch them process it, and see what it is that they need. Do they need to be told what to do? Do they need to be given instructions on how to get from point A to point B? Or do they need to witness you in your totality and your desire and your feeling? And then then act accordingly and from a place of inspiration or from a place of having witnessed you. It's really about the collapse of those two things, especially when two people are collapsed at the same time. Both people are feeling needy. Both people are feeling bossy. Both people are pretending that they don't want as much as they want. Both people are trying not to invade the space of the other too much. It just ends up being such a mess, and people hurt each other inadvertently in that sense.
Mm-hmm. So what has been the impact of this work on the relationships and the lives of the people you've worked with from the context of relationships?
Oh, it's been incredible. I mean, it's been incredible. I mean, everything from the most unconventional polyamorous situations to returning to the most traditional form of marriage to, I mean, more than anything, being able to see a relationship as a continuing evolution where the rules need to always be changing. They need to be set, but they need to be changing because people evolve and people need to update each other. It's been such a privilege and so much fun to watch and so much fun to experiment with these women and see what they come up with their families and their husbands or their boyfriends and their love affairs and their harems of slaves, whichever direction they want to go in.
Well, let's talk about this in the context of business and leadership, because I think that's another really interesting place where power dynamics play out. And I am curious kind of, you know, what your work has shown in that area and sort of what have been the outcomes that you've seen. And, you know, if you're talking to business leaders, what are the kinds of things that you tell them about power dynamics?
I'm sort of monomaniacal about this. So for me, the lens of power dynamics influences everything from childcare, pet training, big multinational affairs, the presidential election. You better believe I was watching those debates being like, oh, why did he go dumb? Bad Dom, sup, Dom. To me, this is about humans being able to communicate on a level that where their words match their most primal communication. And when I speak in very business-oriented situations or in military situations, which I'm proud to say I got to do, One of the best examples is the interview, the job interview. That's a good one. I'll tell you about that one. Okay. So when I was working with students who were about to graduate Yale from the School of Management, they had a lot of questions about how to be with recruiters and how to be in business situations, business interviews, job interviews. And so we role played a bunch of interview scenarios, and the pattern became really, really evident. What worked, what didn't work. The inclination when you're in the chair across from somebody who you want to give you a job is to go sub, right? To put all the attention on yourself, to talk about your achievements, your accomplishments. And you see this even, you can feel it in the room. It's so hard to write about and talk about this stuff because it becomes so apparent that the weight of attention and energy is on the sub. The attention's always on the sub. And so here you are interviewing for a job, talking about yourself. And if you switch for a moment, if you switch and go dom and ask the person who is interviewing for a job some intelligent questions, put attention on their needs, the power dynamic shifts so fast, and it ends up being connected in a way that wouldn't be normally if the power structure wasn't able to have fluidity. So, I mean, we have lots of scenarios with, like, women who are afraid to ask for a raise, and scenarios where, like, the woman in the meeting thing, where a woman's in a meeting and she says, or she says something, and 5 minutes later, a guy says the same thing. Mm-hmm. And everybody hears it from the guy, but they don't hear it from the woman. So a lot of the coaching that I do around that has to do with, yeah, sure, there's sexism, but if you watch what tends to happen, not always, tends to happen, when a woman is speaking, her idea, her attention, and her sphere of attention is very small and enclosed around herself, and the bodies of the other people in the room can't feel what she's saying. And then the guy says it, and it's almost like he scores the goal. And because he scored the goal, doesn't matter that she said 75% of it already, he gets the victory. It's like the habit pattern of men in situations like that specifically is they're so good at making sure that their voices land, that their attention lands, that the whole room feels like it's vibrating to the sound of his voice, that it's almost inevitable that there would be a dissatisfaction in the room if the woman had said it the way that a woman in that situation tends to say it, and then the guy didn't follow up to make a slam dunk.
Interesting. You know, it's, I think the really interesting thing to me is when you're talking about sort of shifting the dynamic from the attention being on you and trying to sort of qualify yourself to this person who's interviewing you to asking them questions and listening. I don't remember what chapter it was, but it was one of the chapters in the 48 Laws of Power. Robert Greene talked about the power of silence and how it creates this very interesting sort of space where people will actually fill it, and you'd be amazed what they'll tell you. It's something that I've learned as an interviewer too.
That's so cool. That's one of the exercises we do in the school too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now let's both be quiet and see who speaks
first. See who speaks first. Let's see who's going to break the stalemate. So what have you seen in terms of outcomes in the lives of people in terms of their careers? Have they, like, gotten promotions, like climbed the ranks? I'm really curious kind of what they've done in that aspect of their lives with all of this.
Let's see. There's one woman who was working for a nonprofit that she really cared about, but the thing was a mess. She was doing the job of two people waiting for the other person to get hired, who never got hired. So she ended up being in a situation where she was literally doing the job of two people, having one title and the pay of one person. And throughout the workshop, we worked on her creating a series of asks that would have her use the colleagues that she had to create teams and make requests of her boss that ended up creating not just that she had twice as much pay or got compensated for doing the job of two people, but that she got her own division.
Wow.
And ended up having a position that would have been much, much higher than the equivalent of those two positions combined. And that was really fun. Like these things are great because sometimes in a power dynamic, situation, the irritation or the problem can be really, really small, but so, so ubiquitous that it makes the life of the person working in that company miserable. And the solution's really simple. Or it can be like the first example I just mentioned, where it's like a game of puzzle piece game, like one request after another, and all of a sudden you have this entire new side of an enterprise and a very much more powerful position.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about this. I think back to a part of my career where I was like truly miserable because I was working with an abusive salesperson and a boss who just seemed to have it out for me so much so that he even threw me under the bus on his way out the door. I mean, I ended up leaving that company before I was about to be fired. But I kind of wonder, looking back at this, if I knew, you know, what I know now from having conversations with people like you, if I'd understood power dynamics, I could have, you know, turned that situation to work in my favor.
I wonder.
Yeah,
what I mean, would have done.
Well, I'm curious. So let's say that you're dealing with somebody who's abusive at work and just making your life miserable, and you have a boss that you just can't stand, you know, which is the scenario that I was in. What would your work enable somebody like me to do in that situation?
Well, then I'd have to get a little bit more specific with you. What was he doing?
Well,
what's abusive mean?
So lots of things. I mean, preventing me from going to conferences and stuff when everybody on the team was there, but I was told to stay in the office. That was one of them.
Did you ask him why?
No, I didn't. I was chained to a desk pretty much all the time. I was very rarely allowed to be in client meetings, even though I could communicate extremely well. And then there was another moment where rather than, you know, even though I had to take over for a salesperson, rather than applying for the job, they found somebody from the outside rather than asking me to apply for the job. I mean, just over and over. I mean, you know, on some level, I hated the job, so that probably wasn't, you know, anything I could hide.
Did you bear all of this in relative silence?
Yeah, more or less.
So, I mean, there's 100,000 things you could have done. I don't know how that would have turned out any differently, but...
I did speak up to HR once about the abusive salesperson, and she ended up actually quitting about 6 months after that. But not a whole lot changed as a result.
But see, that's the thing. The thing about HR is great in companies, but it's a third party. And to shift a power dynamic, it's most effective to do it... what like directly one-on-one. And the other thing is that in situations where there's like a decorum or there's a protocol, there's a way to dom somebody in an effective way that's softer, that's still within the framework that's acceptable. Like I can't have one of my students go to her boss and lean over her desk and stick her tits out and go, "You like making me suffer, don't you? You like giving me the shittiest little position. You love watching me squirm. Does that give you pleasure? Would it give you pleasure if I suddenly collapsed at work?" And, you know, like, that doesn't work. So, but definitely turning the tables, especially in terms of attention. I recently had a situation where actually there was a kind of a similar situation, and the student basically found a way to put attention on her superior, ask a few questions about why she does things the way that she does, and then went sub and explained the impact of that, and then made a request so that there was like a feeling of acknowledgement, a moment of reversal of power, and then an opportunity to move forward.
Wow. Well, this has been fascinating. So I have two last questions for you. This is something I've been asking a lot of people about. If you could recommend one book to our audience, what would it be? What one book has profoundly influenced your work in your life?
I'm not kidding when I say The Dog Whisperer, Cesar Millan's book. If you read it from the angle, if you read it through a lens of looking at human beings as being in the same predicament as dogs, where you have, you know, you put a dog in a situation where they think that they're in charge, but they don't have what they need in order to lead the pack, which is basically what happens with dogs that are domesticated. It really changes your view about what a human being needs to do or needs to have in order to do what they're asked to do. And suddenly you're really grateful that you have language too, that you can communicate with people and use that.
Well, I will have to add that to my list of books to read. So one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
that on every level, they're broadcasting the truth of what they think and feel at that very moment, and that they're responding to the alive, ever-arising impulse that comes through human beings moment by moment by moment. You can't forget a person like that. You don't forget their names. You don't forget their faces. They're unmistakable. Because everybody's tuned to a different channel, and everybody has something that's uniquely theirs to say. And if they're with that on some level, you can't mistake them for anything else, and you can't forget them.
I love that. Well, this has just been really fascinating and interesting, as I expected it would be. Where can people learn more about you and your work?
My website, kashaurbaniak.com, which is KASIAURBANIAK.
Cool. For everybody listening, we will link up everything in the show notes, and we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
To increase its persuasive success. Mm-hmm. And the set of factors that moved me from the original model of social influence that says you have to arrange the content of your message correctly to get people to say yes to it, which I still believe, right? But there was a new model as well that I started seeing evidence of that caused me to see this alternative way of creating change, and that was to essentially create a mindset in the recipient of a message that would be consistent with the message that hadn't even been encountered yet. But if it would be possible to put someone in a frame of mind that made that person attuned to the strengths of our subsequent message, that would produce genuine traction. That would give us genuine leverage when the message eventually did occur.
Robert Cialdini joins us to talk about using principles of persuasion to make our communication more effective.